This podcast is part of the Everyday Heroes Podcast Network, the network for first responders and those who support them.
Hey guys, welcome to the Hero Academy podcast, the place where you can celebrate and highlight our frontline heroes, people such as nurses, firemen, EMS, police officers, and military are all heroes without capes. I don't care about politics, only positivity and purpose. I only care about those that have chosen to serve our society. I believe in collaboration over competition. Here, you'll learn the secrets and strategies that let ordinary people become extraordinary inside of their purpose. Sometimes we'll throw in some simple side hustles that everyday regular people are doing, things that you could do to make some extra money, especially if you're starting to think about retirement and what's next. Inside this podcast, each week you'll learn from people like you that were working full time but still found the time to create a course, grow a big team, create a coaching program, a large audience, or a profitable side hustle. The steps they took, their backstories, and how they overcame their burnout that they were facing. The perfect blend of mindset and techniques. Carpe diem. Now let's get your dream lit for your freedom. I'm your host and coach, Super Dave. Let's go.
Hey guys, welcome to this week's episode of the Hero Academy podcast. I am very, very excited to have my friend Randy. Randy has this amazing company. I'm gonna let you tell all about it, but just tell us your story.
Well, it's not a company, it's an organization.
Okay.
I'm the founder of The Wounded Blue. The Wounded Blue is the national assistance and support organization for injured and disabled law enforcement officers. It's a nationwide charity that is devoted to the to helping injured and disabled cops, whether those injuries are physical or emotional and psychological, because we all know that post-traumatic stress can be as real as a bullet. So we recognize those injuries. And my organization is made up of police officers from all over the country. And every one of my officers, we call ourselves the peer advocate support team. Everybody on this team has been either shot, stabbed, beaten, run over, screwed up and screwed over, faced a serious post-traumatic stress and came out on the other side of the abyss. And yet they continue to serve. Some are in wheelchairs. Some have been blinded. Some have been, you know, injured in very dramatic ways. And they're true heroes. They continue to serve their fellow officers, whether they're active duty or, you know, have become disabled and can no longer work. So they're doing amazing stuff for saving lives. You know, we're deep in the anti-suicide space because there's so much emotional issues going on with law enforcement across the country for a myriad of reasons. So the organization has been during May in Police Week, we'll be celebrating our fifth anniversary, and that will be 14,000. More than 14,000 cops that we've helped in the last 5 years, which is an astounding number.
That's incredible. So is it a nonprofit?
Yes, it is a national nonprofit.
So that's the difference between it being a company and it being an organization.
Correct. And one thing that is very, very important to know, because we all have been, exposed to the fact that some charities like to, you know, pay themselves in big ways. I take no salary. I take no pay. I live on my pension from my retirement as a Las Vegas police lieutenant and on my disability because I was permanently disabled in the line of duty.
Can you tell us about that story? I try to usually not go dark, but I know you talk about it a lot.
Well, yeah, because it's part of the pathway that led to the creation of the Wounded Blue. So I was a cop for 34 years in total. I did 10 years in Princeton, New Jersey. I was a road cop for 6 years, detective for four. But it was a 30-officer police department. And I got to tell you, in a college town, I was just bored to death, man. So I decided I need more action. Well, where do you go for more action as a cop? Vegas. And so I started my career all over again. I had to test for the job. There were 5,000 applicants. Shows you the difference between then and now. Now they have a test of if 500 people show up, it's a lot. But there were 5,000 people that showed up for 100 spots. I was very fortunate and made the cut and joined Las Vegas Metro. Had to go through the academy again, go through field training again, and literally begin all over. And I'm glad I did, because it I loved working for Metro. It was a great place to be a cop. I experienced things that I never would have been able to experience anywhere else. It came with a cost. And after 24 years, I was a lieutenant. And I spent my entire lieutenant's career on graveyard shift. Why? Because that's where the action shift is in Vegas. And I loved being a street cop. So the lieutenant's rank is the last rank you can actually go out in a police car and actually do some policing. And so I was watch commander on this particular night, which meant, you know, the watch commander is highest ranking officer on duty. Yep. And whenever I was watch commander, I would take a patrol officer with me so that I could get to know my people. And also they could get to see their lieutenant actually knew how to do some police work now and then, right? So I had this young man with me, never ridden with me before. And we're on Las Vegas Boulevard, the famed strip, right in front of Bally's Hotel, and I'm talking to him like I'm talking to you, and suddenly I found myself talking slower, and I had no ability to change that. I literally felt my brain slowing down. Wow. And realized that I was having a stroke, and I stopped the police car right in the middle of the road, and I said, get me medical, I'm having a stroke. And this poor kid looked at me like, is this the way lieutenant messes with people, right? But he realized that this was no, we're not playing here. So I got out of the car to go around to the passenger side in case he needed to get me to the hospital, and started speaking gibberish. I had no control over it. I knew I was speaking gibberish. And then I lost the ability to speak and move altogether and crumpled to the pavement. And that's where my career ended. Literally on the street, with people walking by me, taking pictures of me. You know, completely helpless. And it was the most frightening moment of my life. And I've had some frightening moments, I can tell you that. I wasn't afraid of dying. I was afraid of living like that. And once again, that angel that's been on my shoulder my entire career was with me again. And the blood clot went through my brain, did some damage, but certainly not what it could have done. But it ended my police career. Now, 3 weeks before that, my mother died in my arms. And 2 months before that, I was involved in another fatal shooting. So there was a lot going on in my life at the time. But they determined I had a severe heart condition that I didn't know about, and that's what caused it. So what happened then was life-changing for me. I mean, that's not enough of a life-changer. But my own department turned its back on me and said, we're not paying your medical bills. And we're not giving you your benefits. Have a nice life.
Wow.
And I was shocked. I said, well, what do you mean? You have to pay my medical bills. This is a non-duty injury. It's written right in the statute. Yeah, we know that, but we're not accepting your claim. And they forced me to go to court. I had to get a lawyer.
Wow.
I had to go to court. It took over a year. They knew I was going to win. And this is the crazy part. They knew I was going to win, but they were pushing. They appealed every single. I won every hearing, and they appealed every hearing because they were stretching it out because they knew it would take more than a year. And the reason why they did that was so startling that to this day, when I tell people, they get this shocked look on their face. And the reason they did it was because they were playing the actuarial game and hoping that I would die in the meantime so they wouldn't have to pay.
Wow.
That's a bitter pill to swallow. And it created, I felt abandoned. I felt alone. I felt that my department had betrayed me. After all the service did. I almost lost my life for this department on more than one occasion. And I went to go see the sheriff, who I'd served with for 24 years, and I said, how do you treat me like this? He looked me dead in the eye and said, Randy, this isn't personal. It's just business.
Wow.
So now I've done a lot of other things along the way, David, besides being a cop. I was the most featured officer on the show Cops. I've been in movies. I was in the movie Casino with Robert De Niro and Sharon Stone. I was in Miss Congeniality 2 with Sandra Bullock, and Fools Rush In with Salma Hayek, and a bunch of movies and TV.
How do you get in those movies?
Well, what happened was one day I get a phone call, and it's a casting agent, and said, there's going to be a film shot in Vegas, and the director is looking for realism in the part of a police officer, and we saw you on Cops. Would you come down and do an audition? I said, yeah, sure. So I walk into this suite, the old Riviera Hotel, which doesn't even exist anymore, and who's standing there but Robert De Niro and Martin Scorsese. And normally, I came to find this out, I didn't know at the time, normally on an audition like this, they hand you some lines to read, and then you read the lines with the director or another actor, and they determine if you can, you know, if you're right for the part or not. Well, I started telling stories about being a Vegas cop, and I got some pretty good stories. and they said, forget it, don't bother reading the lines. You got the part. And that's how I got in the Screen Actors Guild, and I've been doing movies and TV ever since.
All right, before you go into the book, you have to tell some of those Vegas stories, because I know they're in the books. I know you've told them before, but I want you to tell my audience some of those stories of being a Vegas cop, because I just left Vegas. My girl had no desire to go there, but I told her, I said, there's a lot more to do than just gambling. And we went for some hikes, and we had an actually good time. We went to the Spear. We saw a show at the Spear. And we went to a really cool restaurant. But what was it like serving in Vegas? Because it's a crazy town.
So, all right. So let me draw a distinction here. So, like I said, I was a cop in Princeton for 10 years. And during my time there, we called ourselves grin and wave cops. Hi, Mrs. Smith. Hi, Mr. Jones, you know, right? Because I knew everybody. It was my hometown. But it just was, there was no excitement going on. So I come to Vegas, go through the whole academy again, and I'm still on probation when, and I'm working in the hood and graveyard shift, which is where all rookies went, of course, as always.
Isn't the hood of Vegas pretty much everything outside of the strip?
No. Now, well, let me put it this way. At that time, there was a real hood.
Okay.
Now there's little hoodlets.
Okay.
Right. So there's spots around. So, but I was in the only area where we rode two-man cars, and that gives you an indication. So one night, I'm just at the academy. I'm finally out on my own with my partner, and we get involved in a pursuit with a stolen car. And the car crashes, they bail, I run after the driver, my partner runs after the passenger, and I'm huffing and puffing, but I'm still in pretty good shape because I'm just out of the academy. So I'm right on this guy's ass, but I can't quite get my hand on him. And he goes around the corner of a building, and I go around the corner of a building, and he's waiting for me, and he's going to ambush me. He's got his gun up,
Oh my God. And
I've got my gun in my hand anyway. And so when I spotted him, I instinctively, you know, fired a round, and the round zinged right by his ear, and it hit the building that he was next to, and a piece of the stucco hit him in the head. So he thought I shot him, and he couldn't throw that gun away fast enough. Well, it turned out he was 15 years old, 15-year-old gangbanger. Yeah. And it's okay. This is the moment. This is the you're not in Kansas anymore, Toto, moment. When, yeah, you wanted more action, Randy. Well, guess what? You just got it. And over the ensuing years, I was in 5 shootings and survived.
So that was critical incident number one.
That was critical incident number one.
Oh my God. And then there were 4 more after that.
Well, and the last one was 2 months before I retired. I was in a fatal shooting. And then a month after that, my mother died in my arms. And then 3 weeks after that's when I had the stroke.
Oh my God.
So there was a lot of action. You know, being a cop in Vegas, you know, it was nonstop action and a lot of funny stuff, of course, interspread with, of course, all the tragic stuff that you see. You know, this is a rough town. There's a lot of crime. And, you know, I saw my share of it. And it had an effect. Like every other cop, it had an effect. But I also had some of the most incredible moments that were life-changing. For instance, I was a sergeant, and I was on patrol one afternoon. I was a 3 to 11, 3 to 1 shift. And I'm on right just off the strip in like a casino area, you know, business area. And I see a car up on the sidewalk and people are running around screaming. I have no idea what it is, but I know it's not good because I'm a trained investigator. And I call for a backup. I jump out of the car and I look and there's bullet holes all over the car. And somebody screams, "Oh my God, the baby's been shot." And I look down and there in a little infant seat is a 1-month-old baby who was shot in the face. Turned out there were 3 gangbangers in a gang initiation. Just pulled up to this car, mom and dad and a little baby in the back seat, and opened fire. And one of the rounds hit the baby in the face. And of course, you know, her head's the size of a softball. So I look down, called for an ambulance, but realized the baby's not breathing. And I knew that if I waited for the ambulance, which is the standard procedure, that baby was going to die. So the first patrol car that got there, I jumped in it, said, "Tell them we're bringing in a baby that's not breathing." And when the baby was shot in the face, all the tissue and stuff went down her throat and choked her. So I was able to clear her airway and give her mouth to wound resuscitation. And because I was there literally within minutes of the shooting, I revived her and no brain damage. Which of course is the thing that, you know, you really, you know, that's a big deal. And so I was able to save her life. And that was a life-changing moment for me in a couple different ways. One, it was such an emotional time for me that I went home and I wrote the story about her, called Her Name Was Jackie. And not because I had anything to do. I just needed to write it. I felt like it was something that I just had to do to, you know, kind of understand my own feelings about what just happened. So I wrote the story on a yellow pad, stuck it in a drawer, and it sat there for a little over 3 years. And then the World Trade Center was attacked. And of course, like everybody else that wore a badge at that time, I was very frustrated not being able to help in the efforts there. You know, 72 cops were killed. You probably knew some of them. And I just felt like I wanted to do something to help those families. And I thought about that story that was in that drawer in that nightstand over there. And I said, you know what? Every cop I know has a story. I'm going to ask them to write that story. I'm going to put it in a book. And I'm going to donate all the royalties to the Widows and Orphans Fund for the cops who were killed, New York PD and the Port Authority. And that's what I did. And through an incredible set of circumstances, a major publisher picked it up. And that book is that.
True Blue.
And you'll see that the NYPD gave me that beautiful picture. And that patch as a symbol of respect. And we raised some substantial money. What I never intended was to be a writer. But St. Martin's Press, who published that book, liked my story so much, they asked me to write my own book of just my stories. And that's called A Cop's Life. And it is still available today on Amazon.
I'm getting it.
Then I wrote another book called, it was the second in the series, True Blue, called To Protect and Serve, and I donated the royalties to the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. And then when I retired, because of all the things that had happened to me, you know, from the stroke, and then the doctors told me, Randy, you got to think about your own mortality because you got a serious heart condition and you could suffer another stroke at any moment. And I didn't expect that, you know? So I was thinking about what my legacy was going to be. And then once again, in the weird way that the world works, I happened to be watching television and I saw an interview with a man named Frank Shankiewicz. Now that name may not ring a bell to you, but what he did will. He is the man who created the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Mm. And what people don't know is that a cop created the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Frank Shankiewicz was an active duty trooper when he created Make-A-Wish, and he was a cop for 40 years. And I saw his interview, and I was so touched by that interview and his story that a light bulb went off in my head, and I said, that's it. I want to talk to people like Frank Shankiewicz who have done something so incredible with their lives. And I want to know who it was in their life that gave them that inspiration. And that gave birth to my fourth book called The Power of Legacy, Personal Heroes of America's Most Inspiring People. And my first interview was Frank Shankiewicz. And from that interview began a lifelong friendship. And he was the first member of my board of directors for the Wounded Blue. And until the day he died, just a couple of years ago, he was my mentor, my friend. So we never know the pathways that are going to be open to us. I thought that having that stroke was the worst thing whatever that could ever happen. You know, and within weeks, I lost my mom, I lost my job, I lost my identity. And then cops from around the country, because of being in the movies and having written books and having been a police trainer for many, many years, one of my jobs with Metro, I was in charge of advanced training. And I had written an article called Policing with Honor. And it touched a chord around the country. And I started getting phone calls from police departments. Hey, do you present on this topic? And I said, well, I can. And I created Policing with Honor, How to Survive Your Career Ethically, as well as physically and emotionally. And I taught police officers around the country. So from being so visible in the law enforcement community, cops started reaching out to me. Randy, I know you don't know me, but I was shot in the line of duty and my chief threw me away. He didn't even visit me in the hospital. They're not paying my medical bills. Randy, I know you don't know me, but I was hit by a car. Randy, I know you don't. I mean, one after another. And and everybody said the same thing. I feel abandoned. I feel alone. I never expected this. And I realized that this is a national issue. And I looked around for resources for them and discovered there were none. And that's why I created the Wounded Blue. And we've been touching lives ever since. And I have the most incredible team of men and women who are devoted to helping their brothers and sisters. And our motto is never forgotten, never alone.
14,000 to date in 5 years. That's amazing. That's an incredible story. I want to read the legacy book. That's the one that stood out to me the most, but also A Cop's Life. Those two, I definitely want to get.
Well, a lot of police academies started using A Cop's Life because it's a harsh book. I mean, when I was writing it, my father was dying. So there was a lot of darkness in this book. And, you know, I'm no stranger to post-traumatic stress myself. There have been some very dark days in my life. And I don't sugarcoat it. And it's a very real book. And I've had so many cops contact me and say, Randy, thank you for writing that book and sharing, because I thought I was alone in my feelings. And that is the number one cause for post-traumatic stress. We think we're alone in the feelings that we have, and we're not. And we share those same feelings, but we don't want to talk about it. So that's why this book was so important to so many people.
What is, how do you make money?
Besides
your pension? You don't?
I don't. Everything that I bring in for the Wounded Blue stays with the Wounded Blue. We're actually doing something really cool right now that I am very proud of. I just got back from Nashville about 4 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and came out with a deal that is amazing. This just happened. In fact, I go on Fox News day after tomorrow to talk about it. I've got ABC News today, this afternoon, to talk about it. But I have some of the biggest country stars in history are signing guitars for the Wounded Blue to help us raise money. I'm talking Toby Keith. I'm talking Travis Tritt, Reba McEntire, Dolly Parton, Dierks Bentley, Miranda Lambert, Vince Gill. I mean, I'm talking about the absolute who's who of country music. And they're all supporting the Wounded Blue. And we've got a website, guitars4cops, guitarsforcops.com. We're selling these guitars for $1,000 a piece. And all that money is going to go help injured and disabled officers across the United States.
That's amazing. How did you link up with whoever you linked up with in Nashville? How'd you arrange that?
Through another weird set of circumstances. There was going to be a huge country concert in Huntsville last year. Sold out in the biggest auditorium that there is, 7,500 people, covered by television. Well, 3 weeks before, 2 weeks before the concert, two Huntsville police officers were shot. One was murdered and the other was severely injured. And George Jones's widow, who was putting this concert on through the management company that I wound up becoming associated with, wanted to do something for those families. So they reached out to the Wounded Blue. And through another type of guitar setup, like what we just did, we raised almost $100,000 for those two families in like 3 weeks. So that's how I got associated with them. And they love our mission. And for the next year, we're going to be doing country music fundraisers around the country. We've got one scheduled in May, day after Police Week, in the largest country music venue on the East Coast called the Cadillac Ranch in Connecticut. And Heath Wright and his band Ricochet are going to be the featured band. And the venue is owned by a retired cop. He's given it to us for free to help us raise money for the Wounded Blue.
I noticed that country was pretty big in Vegas.
Well, you were here during or just at the end of National Finals Rodeo.
Okay.
It's one of the biggest things in Vegas.
I stayed right by Formula One's building.
Mm-hmm.
The Uber driver was telling us that they had shut down the roads.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea that they did that on like public roads.
Listen, you got enough money in Vegas, anything can happen.
So you only collect your pension and you don't make any money outside of the organization? Like, I don't mean anything not attached to the organization. I mean, you don't do anything outside. Everything is donated. Your book revenue, your speaking. Everything.
I actually have a new book coming out called Rescuing 911, The Fight for America's Safety. And I'm using that as a fundraiser for the Wounded Blue as well. But yeah, all the speaking engagements that I do, I take all that money, I put it back into the Wounded Blue.
But you don't have to, because that's not part of.
No, I don't. No, I don't have to. But
it's what you do.
It's my, this charity is my legacy. you know, and listen, I just suffered another stroke just 4 months ago.
Oh my God.
So mortality is very much on my mind. And it's important for me that my legacy be untarnished. And you know, I have seen what happens with certain people when they have very successful charities.
You know, the Wounded Warrior had a big scandal.
Right. Yeah, they did. And they're not the only one. I mean, there's a lot of big charities. In fact, Frank Shanquist he left Make-A-Wish, the organization he founded, because it became so big that the directors were paying themselves astronomical salaries. Mm. And he balked at that and said, that's not what this charity is about. And so they fired him. Mm. So believe me, I've seen this play out time and time again. So it's really important to me personally that I stay focused on mission and pure. That I live, listen, I get a decent pension. I can live on that. I live a great life. I'm completely happy. I don't need a super yacht. Well, it might be kind of fun, but so yeah, it's not something that is in my nature.
So are you against directors taking any kind of?
No, I'm not. No, I'm not. And there, believe me, it is perfectly legitimate to take a salary when you're doing a job. I mean, you're running a nationwide, if you're running a charity and you know, you have to make a living. So I'm not against that. I'm not against doing that.
It's just not for you.
It's just, I'm fortunate enough to have a source of income where I don't have to drain any resources from the charity to live on. But that's me because I'm, you know, because I get a pension. So it's afforded me that opportunity. I don't hold any issues with taking a salary. I really don't. It's just I'm fortunate enough that I don't have to do that.
Do you know, living in Vegas, do you know a lot of wealthy people that can donate?
Well, you know, I know some, and I've had some pretty good donations, not as many as I would like. I mean, we're literally scratching around every month to raise enough money to keep things going. You know, like we got some pretty cool stuff in the works. We got the guitar promotion. I was just, you know, to show you how powerful what we do is. We were just donated a beautiful brand new Harley, and it's gorgeous, right? And we were donated this by a retired Los Angeles County Deputy Sheriff. And the reason that she did it was because she credits the Wounded Blue with saving her life when she was suicidal. Her husband was murdered in the line of duty, who was also a deputy. And she struggled for years with depression, post-traumatic stress, and was literally on the verge. And I'm not telling a tale out of school. She's given me permission to tell her story. Otherwise, because everything we do is confidential. But she came out publicly and said, "The Wounded Blue saved my life." So as thanks, she donated this huge, beautiful Harley Davidson to us. And we're going to begin a sweepstakes to raise money for the Wounded Blue. We're going to paint it. I've got a donation from a real cool painter who's going to paint up the bike in Wounded Blue colors and thin blue line colors. And as an honor, we're going to put this deputy sheriff's husband's LAPD shield number and end of watch on that bike as a memorial to him. And then we can't auction it off. Well, we could, but I don't. We're going to do a sweepstakes on it, and then do the drawing. Hopefully, at Sturgis, and hopefully raise a lot of money for the Wounded Blue. So we've got country music happening. We got the Harley donation. We've got another woman, deputy who we helped, she's got some very, very prestigious friends, and they are doing a huge fundraiser for us in July up in Oregon. So, you know, you never know where it's going to come from. Somebody listening to this show right now could say, you know what? I want to get involved with the Wounded Blue.
How do they?
They go to thewoundedblue.org. Now, this is for any officers who are listening. If you are struggling and you're going through some stuff, please reach out to us. We are a resource for every cop in America. We're confidential. We don't say, we have nothing to do with your departments. Because even departments that try to do it right and have, you know, good peer support programs, there's still this huge distrust. Nobody trusts their freaking administrations. And very often for very good reason. And then even if they do it right, you may be working with that peer that you're going to be talking to. You don't want to air your dirty laundry with somebody you work with. So that places us in a very unique position. And we are the National Assistance Organization. So if you're a police officer and you're struggling, or you have been, we deal with retired cops all the time. Just because you leave the job doesn't mean that those memories and those issues fall away. They don't. So we're a resource for that and for families. We do peer support for wives and husbands too. Now, for those that want to support us, they can go to thewoundedblue.org and hit that donate button. We really are looking for the $10 a month donations, $20 a month donations. With enough of those, I could stop begging people for money all the time. So I urge you to go to thewoundedblue.org and do $10 or $20 a month. That would really, really be helpful for us. And for the corporate sponsors, we've got some amazing programs that we're looking for corporate sponsorship for. And we give great credit for those businesses that truly do support us. And you can contact me directly, Randy@thewoundedblue.org. It's Randy@thewoundedblue.org.
Randy@thewoundedblue.org. So are you familiar with Robert Garland?
No.
He has a for-profit company called Fund the First. So it's for first responders. And it's kind of like a Kickstarter campaign. What's the other one that people can say, hey, I'm raising money for?
Oh, well, there's several platforms that do that. We've had a couple GoFundMes.
GoFundMe, that's the one I was thinking right. of. So what he does differently is he says they verify and they take care of first responders, but they take a percentage somehow, and it's all like spelled out up front. But when I was talking to him, I said non-for-profit, and he's like, no, it's for profit. So right. that's the difference between his organization. It's like a GoFundMe, and your organization is a non-for-profit charity.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm.
All right. Man, that's really incredible what you do. For the people that are still on the job, and because I think that you instinctively knew that writing was a form of therapy. I believe that writing is
yes.
Writing is thinking.
Yes.
Did you ever go to a therapist? Did you ever figure that out, that writing was therapy at some point?
Yes. Yeah, I did. Well, I knew when I sat down and wrote that story, it was me, my pen, my yellow pad, and a bottle of Johnny Walker and my cat.
Which is now six cats.
I felt instantly, I felt a relief after I put it down on paper. And it was a joyous thing. You know, saving a life is a joyous thing. I've had other encounters that weren't so joyous. But it was still such an emotional thing. In fact, I was with that little girl who's now 26 years old. Just 3 days ago, we were at lunch together. So
does she have a scar?
She has, yes. She's had like 14 different operations.
Wow.
And she's still got a scar, but she's a beautiful young woman. Caring, still bare, even though she was a month old, she still bears the emotional scars from this too.
Wow.
So, but she's a kind, gentle person, and she's basically my goddaughter.
That's really special. I love to talk to her about that, and not to record it, but just to have a conversation about that whole situation, because I have someone close to me that's gone through multiple surgeries also, so I can understand what that is for the family. So if money wasn't in the equation, because money does rule the world, your organization does need money. I think one of the things that I think is that you need to connect with some more billionaires. Do you know Dana White lives in Vegas?
I have been trying to get hold of Dana White for 5 years.
All right.
I have not been able to break into that barrier. There are so many people with money here.
Yeah.
And the Fertitta brothers,
the Wynn, all of these casinos, there's so many billionaires in Vegas.
I know. And I, believe me, I've been reaching out. I just don't have the juice.
You just need the right connection. You just need to keep networking because you're really only 2 degrees away. Like I asked Brandon, I knew I was going to Vegas. So I asked Brandon Griffin, I'm like, who do you know in your network is in Vegas that I have to talk to? And he said, Randy Sutton. And then he gave me your number. And I said, I'm calling him up. But I was too chicken to reach out to you on Sunday. Plus, I knew my girl wasn't going to be into just hanging out with you for a few hours. But if I was alone.
Your girl might have wanted to hang out with me for a few hours.
If I was alone.
And send you shopping.
She might have, but if I was alone, I definitely would have hit you up and I would have hung out with you. You have so many stories. I could listen to them for an entire day.
Well, I, you know, that's one of the things about being accessible. People reach out to me, cops from all over the country, all over the world. And many times, you know, everybody comes to Vegas, right?
Yep.
So if there is any possibility at all, if I can fit it in my schedule, I welcome them to, you know, reach out to me. I've met some phenomenal people that just reached out because they, you know, saw me on a show or a podcast or followed me, you know, through cops. I mean,
You just reminded me, we didn't talk about your, you got a radio show.
I have a podcast called The Wounded Blue Hour.
And yeah, you're doing so many things. You're writing books, you're running this charity, and then you have the podcast. How often does the podcast go on?
I do three podcasts a week. I do one that is mine. That's the Wounded Blue Hour, and that's on the America Out Loud Network, AmericaOutLoud.com. It's also heard on iHeartRadio and, you know, around there. Then I do the number one law enforcement podcast in the country. Is LEO Roundtable, and it's now being heard on 46 radio stations across the country. That's a Chip DeBlock, who's a retired Tampa detective. That's his show, and we have panelists. We do a panel show 5 days a week. I do one day a week because I just don't have the time. But Chip is on it 5 days a week, and he does this full time. Then I do one out of New York, Albany. With Chris DePermo, who is a retired sergeant from up in the Buffalo area. And that's once a week called iDetective. And then I do guest spots like this very, very frequently. If someone offers me the ability to talk, because you never know who's going to be listening. There may be somebody on that's listening to the show that either struggling, and it doesn't know who to turn to for help. And as a result of hearing this, you know, we may be able to play a role in his or her life. So,
or they have a network that they can plug you into.
Sure.
And they know, you know, they know someone that knows the billionaire.
Very true. Very true. Yeah. So any type of exposure I'm good with. I work 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. That phone is always on. You know, not just for business, but those who reach out. I'm also a peer support team member. So sometimes I get a call 4 o'clock in the morning from somebody who is in pain. And so, you know, I'm very, very accessible. I'll give you an example of something that happened. Not this last Christmas, the Christmas before, I was on Fox News and I was talking about the Wounded Blue. So my deal with Fox News is they don't pay me, but they allow me, they introduce me as retired police lieutenant, founder of the Wounded Blue. And if there's a story that can be, in fact, that's why I'm going to be on Neil Cavuto's show this Friday to talk about the Wounded Blue and the guitar promotion. They allow me to do that. And this half hour after I got off Neil's show, I get a phone call. This man says, you know, I just heard you on Neil Cavuto and I support law enforcement. Tell me more about your charity. And it was very clear this guy was very savvy about charities. And we had about an hour and a half discussion. And he asked me for my 990s, which are our tax forms. And that shows you if you're pissing away money, right? If you're spending it all, if you're, you know, like some charities, they take 90% in quote administrative costs. Well, we're at about 6%. So it's bare bones. So anyway, he called me back and he said, I'm going to make it a happy new year for you. And he sent me $100,000. Yeah. And we used that money. It actually gave me the opportunity. And this is someday, this is what I hope that this will happen. We took a lot of that money. And when I read about an officer being shot in the line of duty or severely injured, I literally flew to their bedside and gave them $1,000 to help with babysitting costs and things like that. So someday, that's my dream, is we will be able to help more cops in their time of need. You know, we tell you what we did last Christmas. This is pretty cool. Of all the cool shit I've done, this was one of the, this ranks right up there. And I'll send you a video after we're done with this show. So I get a call from the president of the Fraternal Order of Police of Utah. And we've done a lot of work together because we've helped a lot of their guys. Great folks up there. And he said, Randy, we have an issue here that we would like your help with. We have a police officer who was severely injured in the line of duty in Texas. Now he lives up here. And included in his injuries, he lost his leg. And he needs a new prosthetic leg. It's worn out and he's literally walking around on a bloody stump. And we want to do a fundraiser to help him. So I said, well, I'll do what I can. We're not set up to be a financial resource because, you know, we don't have that kind of those kind of resources, but every now and then I can pull a rabbit out of my hat. So I said, how much is the prosthetic leg? And he says, well, we think it's about $25,000. So once again, fate plays a role. And I happened to get a phone call from the guy that gave us that $100,000 that day. This was just the way fate worked. And he says, hey, just want to check in with you, see what's happening. And I said, well, now that I got you on the phone, let me tell you about this. And he didn't hesitate 5 seconds. Randy, make it happen. I'll pay for it. So on Christmas Eve last year, I made a phone call to this young man and told him that the Wounded Blue was going to give him a new prosthetic leg. And I tell you, that's the best Christmas present I ever had. And we did it.
That's
By the
awesome.
way, that leg was $117,000.
Where did they get the 120 the 25,000 from? From 25,000 to 117?
They made it up. They made up a figure. They had no idea.
Okay.
So it was. It wound up. The cost of the prosthetic was $117,000, and we took care of it.
This person who donated 100K, is he over 100 millionaire? Like over 100 million? Is he multi millionaire?
I don't know. I've never met him.
You've never met him.
He is a voice on the telephone.
Wow.
He is my angel voice.
Wow.
And we've done other things together too. He wants to remain completely anonymous. And believe me, with his help, we've helped some amazing. We've done some amazing things.
I'm thinking of someone who I can give your phone number to, who would probably want to remain anonymous as well, and he would probably do a similar scenario where he's just a angel on the phone, and remain completely anonymous because that's the type of person that he is. But I'm thinking of someone who I happen to have one billionaire's phone number in my cell phone contacts, but I try not to abuse the phone. No, because I know he gets a lot of messages and a lot of text. So
when you're a business or owner, or like these casinos, they're so well insulated because everybody's hitting them up. Everybody, there's a gazillion charities out there, and a lot, you know, many of them are doing really good work,
right?
So they're getting hit up all the time. I understand that, man. And so, you know, it's but so that's the challenge. But you know, I guess you know, you've heard the expression, if it was easy, everybody'd be doing it, right?
Ain't that the truth? Ain't that the truth? I respect your time, so I'm just going to wrap up with my five last questions that I pretty much ask everybody. What's your definition of a hero?
A hero is someone who changes the lives of others for the better. Someone who plays a role that is so important in another person's life that it changes the world.
I love that answer. I think you're the first to ever give me that one. When you're starting to feel stressed now, because I know you have to really watch your stress levels, how do you save yourself? How do you show yourself love?
I got to tell you, I'm very, very fortunate. I have a great support system, and I share things. I don't bottle them up. When I'm stressed out, I'm verbal about it, and I look for solutions. And so sharing problems when you have them with somebody that cares about you, or with people of like mind, that's really, that is for me critical to dealing with stressful issues.
You writing anything else? This is kind of like off of my list, but are you writing?
Yes, I'm right now. I'm just finishing up with Rescuing 911, The Fight for America's Safety. Yeah, right. This is a book that is a call to action.
When do you expect that one to be due?
I'm going to say 2 months.
2 months. And are you self-publishing or?
I am self-publishing this one, yes.
Okay, so that's how you're getting it out so fast. From the moment you sat down to write it, when did you start writing that one?
It's been about a year.
It's been about a year. Okay. So how many books have you written? Anyway, I'm curious.
This will be my fifth.
Fifth book. I'm on number two, which I'm hoping will be out in January. So I'll let you know when that does come out. My first book, I didn't write to any particular audience. I just kind of wanted to write a book. And I wrote a book about personal development. My next book will be to a very specific audience. It's entrepreneurial first responders. So
That's great. That's a great topic. You know, there are a lot of entrepreneurial first responders.
And they can donate to your charity.
Especially those freaking firemen.
Don't they all seem to have some other career? Like, they have the greatest schedules in the world.
Ever created.
Ever created, I know. And everyone loves a fireman, too. I was under the impression, before I started talking to more of them, I was under the impression that they didn't have any stress.
No, they deal with their stuff, too.
They do have PTSD because they see a lot of trauma as well.
Right.
What's your greatest strength? What's your greatest ability today?
That's a question I've never been asked before.
Hey, I got one. What's your power? Like, if people say, hey, this is what you're good at.
I think that my power is compassion. My power is my compassion for others and channeling that compassion into something positive. I believe that empathy and compassion are what makes the difference between the lower life forms that exist and people who create a better world. And if you don't have compassion, you don't have empathy. First of all, I don't want to have anything to do with you. And I judge people by that level that they have.
So one of the things that made me so excited to talk to you and so excited to follow you on all of the platforms, I follow you on Instagram. I tried to connect with you on LinkedIn. So make sure you add me on LinkedIn. One of the things that had me so excited to connect with you was the fact that you are a creator of things. You're not out here competing with anyone else or any other charity. You're just a creator from your heart and from your compassion. So that, to me, is so exciting when I find someone else who is creating things to help people.
You actually said something of very, very key importance there. In the law enforcement charity world, there's a ton of law enforcement charities. And human nature being what human nature is, there's been some very disappointing moments where I have seen people in the charity world that aren't being motivated for the proper reasons. There is so much ego involved and so much infighting in so many ways. And one of the things that is really important to me is to work with other charities. There are so many in the first responder world, in the law enforcement world, that need help. No charity can do it alone. It can't be done. And so working together, I have some of the most incredible resources that are other charities that I know I can call them and say, hey, you know what? This officer needs a service dog, or this officer needs this, and we need to get this guy into treatment for addiction, or we need to and we can reach out. That is one of the biggest strengths of the Wounded Blue, is our relationships with other organizations. And we realize that only by working together can we really serve the people that we want to serve. And unfortunately, I have seen, and I've been the victim of this. It seems that jealousy plays a role in the charity world. And I can tell you that how disappointing it is to hear things about me that simply aren't true, but that get thrown out there because of the pettiness of some of the people that, you know, because of being human. You know, I saw it as a cop too. Like, when I was on the TV show Cops, there were people that hated my guts simply because I was on the show. I mean, it was weird.
Yep.
Weird. Yep. But it's human nature, and I guess you got to live with it. And I would prefer to, you know, hang out with the people that are positive than dwell on the people who are negative.
Amen to that. And my last question, This is a just for fun question. If you had a comic book superpower, what would that superpower be and why? And you can't say compassion. It has to be a
Well,
comic, it has to be a comic book superpower.
a comic book, I'm gonna have to say super strength then.
Super strength.
That would be, I think that would be it. Yeah.
All
I
right.
think that would be because there, when called upon at certain moments, super strength can lead to could lead to playing a real positive role in people's lives.
I'm curious, were you a big power lifter? Were you like a big, 'cause you, I see your shoulders are pretty rounded. Were you big in the gym in your 20s and 30s?
I was a believer in fitness.
But were you jacked though? Were you huge?
Yeah, I wasn't jacked, but I was in pretty good shape. I when I in my younger days, I entered a few power, no, we'll check, you know, bench press contests and stuff like that. And I was pretty strong.
I had a
Now
feeling.
I'm like a harmless old man.
Randy, thank you so much. We're definitely going to do it again. This is like not a conversation that we can just end in 1 hour. So we'll definitely do it again. And I appreciate you so much and your time. You are someone who I definitely want to stay connected with.
All right, family. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Everyone I interview, I've chosen for you guys because of their story, and I hope that you get some value every single time. If you did get value or just simply enjoyed the episode, please share the episode with someone that you know. If you know of a guest, a frontline hero that has an amazing story, something uplifting or a positive message, hit me up in the contact form of www.davidleith.com or DM me at Instagram at davidleith, the number one. Subscribe to the show because I have some really phenomenal guests coming up in the next few weeks that you definitely don't want to miss. All right, one.